The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Ladies and idiots,
this is the Fade to Gray podcast.
Y'all that just got close to God, then God would have healed your marriage. Maybe, but maybe God didn't put us together. Maybe it was just, you know, that's us thing, you know? I had a pretty nasty divorce, and I kind of crawled into a whiskey bottle for about a year and a half, specifically.
How often do you masturbate?
What do you think about the Fade to Gray podcast?
It sucks.
Nice. We out.
We out.
Welcome back, Fade to Gray family and friends. This is your boy, Omar, over here at the Fade to Gray Roundtable, and it's my joy to bring you this week's episode. Now, we are episode 3 into our relationship series, if you guys have been following along. And for some of you guys have noticed, the last two episodes of Fade to Gray have been a little gay. Some very controversial topics maybe have come up, whether it be Amanda's usage of the F word or stories about heterosexual men having orgies with other gay men while their wives watched. It's definitely been controversial this week. It might be what you guys may consider a little more vanilla. Our guest is a personal friend of the family. He is a musician, singer-songwriter, all-around amazing dude, Mr. Tyler Wicks.
Tears after dreaming again. Sundays are stolen by cold medicine. Whispering prayers through faith bleeding again. Feeding my sorrows and drinking my sin. Biding my time just to get to tomorrow. But my rent's due for the time that I've borrowed. I sit here closing my grip.
Now I sat down with Tyler for about an hour and a half and had a very good conversation about his latest music project, The Bottom, which can be picked up in iTunes or wherever you buy your music. To hear more about his album and his artistic process, tune in to a later episode where we release a brand new segment called Open Mic, where we speak with Tyler and other musicians about current music projects, past music projects, or, you know, things that may come up in the future. It could be a lot of fun, a lot of local artists, names you may be familiar with, names you may never heard of, but check them out on Open Mic. Bring us back to that moment where you were thinking, okay, this is the right decision. This is the woman of my life, for my dreams, and clearly I don't need this music thing. This is just a whim. Like, where, how was that decision made?
Okay, well, I'll have to backtrack a little bit and kind of set up a lot of my identity and a lot of my hereditary stuff from my family. Anxiety runs in my family. I made a joke about it at BC Con, but it's like, there's a river of anxiety in my family and I'm at the bottom of the waterfall, just kind of drowning, just tossing and turning, trying to get some air. But it's true though. Like, my mom really struggles with anxiety, my grandma, but they're Pentecostals, so they don't believe in it. And, so like, there's this whole idea that I was brought up with, is that whenever you feel like my parents and my grandma, you know, when you feel like, you know, your heart's about to beat out of your chest, that's the Lord trying to deal with you. Like, it's very emotional. You know, and I know you can relate to this. just this, you know, go by your emotions. And anytime you feel that, that's the Holy Spirit, you know, knocking on your heart. And so I just kind of grew up believing that. And like, looking back now, I realized, no, that's anxiety. My family allows, you know, it's pitiful because they are ran by their anxiety because they think it's God, you know. There's multiple times when I know my mom is having a panic attack that she thinks it's God trying to tell her something. And
unfortunately, there's a lot of that. Like if there's fear involved or anything like that, then, you know, it's definitely the enemy. And so you rationalize or spiritualize, I should say. There's not a whole lot of rational thinking involved, but you spiritualize a lot of these like emotions, and then, yeah. And then you no longer have your own emotions or your own processes. It's all like God trying to tell you something, or the devil trying to influence you in one way or the other. And
definitely. Wow. So take that factor of my decision-making. That was what I made decisions on. I just, okay. Completely just irrational, seat of the pants decisions, because I felt like, oh, the Lord's leading me to do this. And then also factor in that the church kind of lays out this recipe for young dating, courting couples. You just make sure you stay strong and you don't, you don't have sex. And as long as you get married before you have sex, then that's the way God wants it, and you're going to have a great marriage. We were constantly fed quotes like, dance with Jesus, and he'll let the perfect person cut in, that kind of thing. And so it was just this whole built-up recipe. Like, they give you this recipe of a successful marriage. And my ex-wife and I, we waited until we were married, and we were trying really hard to continue to wait until we were married. And then I felt just, mostly probably anxiety because college was tough. But I
you needed
felt
to
like,
fuck.
Yeah. Right.
How old were you?
I was 19.
19. Okay.
19 years old. And I look at 19 year olds now, and I'm like, they're children. Yep. I got married. Like, what was I doing? And I didn't know much about myself, and she didn't know much about herself. But we were supposed to know each other. No. And it was just not an uncommon recipe for marriage disaster.
How long were you guys married, or how far did you get into the relationship until you saw some real red flags, warning signs, like, uh-oh, what's going on here?
I knew it wasn't what I expected the week after we got married. Like, there was no honeymoon period at all. I knew I was in over my head, and I had no idea how to be a husband. And, yeah, but we made it 3 years, but it was pretty, like, I by the end of it, I was really depressed, and I was kind of in a state of not wanting to admit my own depression and just kind of trying to reject that notion. But I didn't want to work. I didn't want to do anything but lay in the bed and do nothing. And, I wasn't holding down jobs, and it was I was shitty. But
what did your support system, like your family or your church, did they see? Because obviously, they're not going to see things at first, but when it gets to that point where there are people like noticing, and what were the conversations being had with like the people closest to you?
Well, the church that I was in was not a very healthy church to be in. It was a church that got a prophecy. I'd become really involved in it. I was trying to be a minister in it, going to ministry classes and everything. And it was very, very just not mentally healthy environment. I was preaching on Wednesday nights. I was a youth director. And it's just like every time I would preach, there would be something wrong with something that I said or something. And like I had that pressure, pressure of trying to go to work and stay at work because I was depressed and like just all this pressure and feeling like a failure as a husband. But I had also put a big distance between me and my family because they kind of saw red flags to begin with whenever I was getting married, and they didn't, they really saw what it is. They're like, you're not really have anything in common. You're too young to get married. And I had rejected all that and just put this big rift between me and my family. Like, I don't need to listen to anything you say. I'm going to, I need to get married. I know it's what God wants me to do, all this stuff. And
Paul said it himself, if you're burning, you don't get married, but if you're burning with lust, then get married.
Old Paul. But Yeah, like, so my family, like, that's kind of what got the ball rolling with, you know, I thought we probably needed to take a break, and then that kind of rolled into getting a divorce. But I was on the phone with Mom, and she could tell I was depressed just by talking to me. And she's like, you should come stay with us a week or something. Like, she was worried about my safety. You know, she was afraid I was suicidal, which I was. Like, every day I'd drive to work, and I would think about just turning the wheel into oncoming traffic. I'm like, that would be a quick way to go, and nobody would know I was killing myself. It would look like an accident. And I thought about that every day. You know, I was in a pretty bad place.
Is that where you developed, like, destructive behaviors, like the alcoholism stuff you said that you dealt with, or just the drinking? Were at that point, or were you not yet? Did it start then, or?
I hadn't. It was after we had split. Was when that. I'd never drank before. You know, I kept my nose clean pretty much in high school and everything. And well, I was at work. I remember, like, me and my ex had split, and I was talking about, I was like, I can't sleep. You know, I'd slept beside the person that I loved for 3 years, and then not having that person there, I couldn't sleep. You know, it was just wouldn't work. And I was talking about it at work, and dude's like, dude, drink you something, and you'll go to sleep. You know, just drink a little whiskey or something, and you'll go. And I'm like, okay, I haven't tried whiskey. And first time I ever tried whiskey, I fell in love with that. Like, and they were like, it's going to be an acquired taste. It's going to taste really bad to you. So you're going to have to get used to it. And, like, I took a first drink, and I'm like, where has this been my whole life? So, alcohol dependency, here we go.
So, all right. Well, that makes, so is there anything else you want to talk about the marriage itself before we start talking about the process of the divorce? Because I want to get into that, obviously, and get into, like, what that was like.
Okay, because there's a really big, really big story. I don't know if you've heard it. I think I've talked about it. I've talked about it definitely on some Church and Other Drugs episodes. But there's a pretty big story arc here that I don't know if it needs to be linear and just kind of go from beginning to end, or how you want to do that.
So obviously, like, I'm curious of, like, what that decision was like to go ahead and say, we're going to separate. And then, like, okay, we need a divorce. And I know from already you telling me of the spiraling and the whiskey that, you know, you didn't see it as a good thing for years. And so, so I just take us through that thought process and how, cause that couldn't have been an easy decision to make.
Grew up, my dad wasn't around, and my mom, she raised me. And my mom's very outspoken, she kind of comes across as shy, but she's really not. I'm eventually going to get a polar bear. Like, my mom hates tattoos, but I'm going to tattoo a polar bear because the polar bear is the most unassuming bear of all of them. Like, you know, you got Coca-Cola polar bears and people think they're cute and cuddly, but really they're no. They're really vicious, you know, and they, you know, they can really do some damage. That's my mom to me. I love her. And, but she can get really angry, especially when I was a child. And, I grew up with this coping mechanism for conflict or for, you know, altercations to just shut down and start apologizing, right? Just don't make it worse. Just go ahead and start apologizing no matter what, and it'll be over quicker. And so that was growing up. And when I got older and a teenager, I had these, you know, like teenage boy anger, it's, you know, management problems. I would just, you know, apologize to her and then go up in my room and, like, you know, scream in a pillow or punch the wall. You know, that was just what, you know, I know we got the whole Kyle joke phenomenon going on, but I mean, that was kind of my coping strategy. I just, you know, it is what it is. So I entered into this marriage with these very immature ways of dealing with conflict. And that's the first thing I did is whenever she would get mad. It was like I said, first week we were married, she was mad. My stepdad at the time wasn't really – I don't consider him at the time to be a good example of a husband at all. He would come home from work and just watch TV and, you know, sit in his chair and do nothing. And he was really rude to my mom, and that's kind of what I had to go off of. And so I would come home from work and I would just sit and I'd watch TV or I'd play video games and just didn't have much to say. And so she was angry that I wasn't helping. And first thing I start doing is apologizing, you know, like if she's mad. Okay. Apologize. So I'm apologizing. I'm sorry. And I'll do better. And then I didn't mean that. Next week I'm coming home just doing whatever I want. And she's like, you know, she brings it back up. I'm sorry, I'll do better. And there becomes this pattern, and she's realizing the pattern. And so she asked to go to marriage counseling. So we go to marriage counseling, and she's telling them about what's going on. And the marriage counselor, I remember he was like, you know, you're keeping a part of yourself from your wife. You know, you're shunning that conflict. He's like, you know, arguments and debates, that's all part of marriage. You're learning each other. You're learning each other's heart. That's part of your heart, whether you know it or not. You know, you're keeping that part of yourself from your wife. You really need, if you have an opinion, if you have a pushback, say it, you know, voice your opinion and reach a conclusion, reach a compromise. You're growing together. Okay. So, I start doing that, and it took a long time. It wasn't just a switch I could turn on, but I started trying to learn to, you know, to talk back and to actually voice my opinion and to say things. And it was like the more that I learned to do that, the more she learned to kind of one-up me, you know, because it was a gradual process. She became more and more vocal, more and more, you know, loud and exaggerated, or, you know, she was learning me. And I mean, basically she would get me, I would come out of my shell and then I would eventually go back in. And it's like there was a point where I resorted to the second coping strategy. And this is what's going on through my mind whenever these events would happen. She knew exactly which, you know, I mean, I'm not accusing anything. I don't want to do anything like, but she would be really angry and be getting up in my face. And I would be just trying to resolve it, trying to talk. And I would get to a point where, okay, I'm really angry right now. And I would never, ever hit you, so I'm going to hit this wall. That's what was going on through my head. And it wasn't until afterwards, like now, and I've talked about this, and it's hard not for me to get emotional talking about this. Looking back, I understand how she could have received a completely different message from that. And what she likely received was, this wall could be your fucking head. You know what I mean? Like, totally different perspectives. And even though I didn't like hurting her feelings. If I said something that hurt her feelings, that crushed me, you know, I hated it. So yeah, I would never, ever physically harm her. And, that happened a few times, and, I could see that she was visibly shaking. Anytime I would snap and hit a wall or something. One time I had a kitchen chair and I just kind of threw it on the ground, just in rage, you know, and I walked out of the room. This likely scared the shit out of her, man. And I didn't really see that then because I knew my intentions weren't, you know, I wasn't trying to harm her. It was just like, just this release of anger. And, I started getting depressed. We're back where we were. Was depressed from the pressures of trying to be a minister and then the not very good mentally healthy church environment we were in. The pressures of being depressed and going to work. And I mean, there was times that I didn't have to work. I would drive to – I worked in Madison, Tennessee. I'd drive and just go up there and see a movie. I'd say I had – you know, I'm going to work, but I was off that day. I would just go see a movie just to not exist for a while, just to be off the grid and not have to deal with the pressures of everything. I'd see movies I didn't care about. I didn't want to, you know, movies I didn't want to see, and just to unplug. And my schedule, my wife started looking at my schedule and seeing that there were days I said I worked that I wasn't working. And she thought I was cheating on her, which understandably so. I understand. I would, you know, it's what I would assume too, I'm sure. And there was just all this pressure, and I had talked to my mom, and she's like, you should just come stay with us for a while. So I was like, okay. So I packed a small bag. It was a little Aeropostale duffel bag of clothes, and I was just going to go to their house for a week. And I called my wife, and I was like, hey, I'm going to go to mom's for a week. I think we just need some time to kind of, you know, think about things. And, you know, I think that we stress each other out right now, and we need to be away from each other for just maybe a week or so and see how that works, see if it helps us any. And she's like, so you're not coming home? And I was like, not tonight, you know, but, you know, like maybe in a week or so. And she says fine. And when she said fine, I could tell she was crying. She said fine and hung up the phone. And I could hear her crying, like just that quivering voice. It tore me all to pieces, and I went back. I turned around and drove back. And she calls me on her way home from work and asks to meet at our pastor's house. So I'm like, okay. So I go to the pastor's house, and my pastor had all these questions. He's like, you know, you got to lay this out on the table. It seems like you've got secrets. And I was like, well, you know, I'm not cheating. I think I'm really depressed. I'm going to the movies just to not exist. You know, it's like therapy, I guess. And, you know, this is going on. And I was like, you know, at the time I was really addicted to pornography, and that's a big deal. You know, I was a minister, and I was preaching against pornography, but addicted to it myself. And so I just kind of laid all this out on the table, and my pastor was like, you guys need to go home and talk about it and work it out and see where you guys need to go from here. And I'm like, okay. And so we were going to leave, and I go to leave, and she was like, hey, I'll be there in a little while. I'll be right behind you. I was like, okay. Cause we drove separate cars anyway. So I drive home, and it was 1 hour, 2 hour, 3 hours. She wasn't there. And, that's when I started getting worried. And I remember going through my mind. I was praying, Lord, please don't let me lose her. Please don't let me lose this marriage, please. And every hour that would go by that she wasn't there, I would become more desperate. And what kept going through my mind was I just kept thinking of David praying that the child wouldn't die. And I kept thinking the child died, though. The child died. And I remember I had our wedding picture. I was clutching it. I took it off the wall, and I was walking around with it just praying and crying. And I get a knock on the door. Thought it was her. I go to the door, and it was my pastor. It wasn't her. And as soon as I saw that it was my pastor and it wasn't her, I fell apart. And I grabbed him and I embraced him, you know, and I was just crying on his shoulder. And he was the coldest I've ever seen that man. He said, you need to get it together, man. You need to pull yourself together. He had no emotion. And I was like, okay. And I just kind of straighten up, you know, wipe my tears, and he come in and he said, she wants you to go to your mom's for a week like you'd planned. She wants you to, you know, she said she also wants you to give me her car key. She wants you to give me your house key, and I need to take the church key from you. And I was like, okay, you know. I was an emotional mess, and I was just agreeing to anything. And at that point, nothing seemed really odd. Like, it was just like, okay, whatever I need to do, whatever she wants, you know, I'll do anything that I can to work this out. I had been brought down to the lowest point of my desperation, you know, whatever, I will do whatever she asked. And so I packed a bag and I went to my mom's. And she called me a week later, and she's like, here's what I want to do. I want you to move out for 3 months. And she's like, I want you to move completely out, get an apartment. And just let us kind of have some alone time and just be separate for a while. And I was like, okay. And so I was like, you know, if that's what you want, I'll do that. And so, she tells me, this is when things started being weird, or I thought were odd. she said, I'm going to put your stuff on the front porch and I'm going to leave and you can come and get it. And then let me know whenever you're gone and you have the stuff so that I can come back. And that's when I was like, well, why? What are you talking about? She's like, that's what I'm going to do. And I'm like, okay. So, stuff was on the porch, went and got it. I let her know. And it wasn't too long after that that she calls me and tells me, she's like, I think that we should date again for a year. She's like, this is what it's going to take for me to trust you again, is if we go back. Because we waited until our wedding day to even kiss. Our first kiss was on our wedding day. And she said that was part of it. She's like, we shouldn't kiss or anything or be alone together at all for a year. And, you know, then, you know, that's what it's going to take for me to trust you again. And that's when I drew the line. And I was like, no offense, but that's absolutely ridiculous. I don't know what's going on, but that's insane. There's no way that we're going to work this out and get closer together if we're further apart. I don't understand what's going on. Like, are you talking to somebody? What's going on? You know? And she's like, it's, you know, the conversation was going and she basically gave me an ultimatum. She's like, it's either that or divorce. I was like, I guess it's divorce then. And so she hung up the phone and like, then we were texting back and forth and she's like, is that what you really want? And more I thought about it, the more I'm like, yeah, I think that maybe that is what we need. Maybe we do need to go our separate ways. If that's the only, you know, if that's what you want to do. And, you know, because there's no way, it's like, there's no way I'm going back to dating for a year. And so she's like, are you going to, I was like, I'll pay for the divorce. That's fine. I wouldn't ask you to do that. I'll do that. And so I was going to get a lawyer. It was going to be uncontested. And, you know, as long, because we didn't have kids together. We didn't own a house together. We were just, you know, we're going to go our separate ways. It was going to be like $600. I don't know. It wasn't going to be much. And I got a hold of the lawyer and I had it all lined up and I texted her. I was like, so if I don't, because the lawyer told me that I would pay him the fee. And then if she didn't sign the papers, it was basically going to be for nothing. So he's like, so make sure she's going to sign, make sure it's, you know, that she agrees, because that's what an uncontested divorce is, that she's going to agree to this. And so I texted her, I said, so you're going to sign the papers, right? And she wouldn't text back. I'm like, confirm with me that you're going to sign the papers, because I have to confirm that before I do this, before I put up this money. And she would not respond. And it was like, I don't know how long, because it's been a while, but I got served papers. She went to a lawyer and it was contested. She wanted to take it to court. So I had to lawyer up. I went to like the shittiest lawyer I could find just to get an uncontested divorce. So I went and got the most expensive lawyer I could find because I didn't know what was going on or what she was trying to do. And took out two loans to pay for the lawyer. And he was trying to keep it from going to court because he told me, he's like, I'm not a cheap lawyer, but I'm trying to do you a favor because you don't have kids. There's no reason for this to go to court. There's no reason for it to be contested. He's like, I'm going to try to get him to settle. I was like, okay. And so he reached out for a settlement. And the settlement was that I took all of the debt that we had accumulated. And also, like, she wanted a $1,500 lump sum, I think. And she wanted my dog. She put that in the papers, which is fine. My dog liked her more than it ever liked me anyway. And, but there's just that settlement. I know I'm getting into some boring details here.
No, you're good. Keep going.
I was like, that's fine. That works. If that's what you want, then that's what I'll do. And so I settled. I remember the day that I signed those papers, the day that I drove to the lawyer's office and signed that paper. It was like, it felt like the most important and maybe possibly, you know, this is either the best decision of my life or the worst decision of my life right now, in this moment, right here. It all hinges on this, you know. That's the pressure that goes along with it. I don't care if you've been married, you know, to someone for 3 years or what, or if less, there's just so much pressure that just goes along with that decision. When I sign this dotted line, there's no turning back. And it was just like throwing away all this progress. Like Louis C.K. talks about it, and I don't, good Lord, Louis C.K.'s not a role model in the least. But he says this thing. He says getting married is like stepping in a time machine, but it's a really shitty time machine because it takes the exact amount of time to get to the other side. He's like, you just realize you've done nothing. You've made no progress. You've actually regressed over that period of time in a lot of ways. And then here you are, you know, on the other side. And it's true. Like, felt like all this progress and all this work that we had done together, you know, we built this, you know, even though it was a shitty marriage, we'd built a lot. We worked a lot on what we had. We were just scrapping it and going right back to scratch. And here I was in the same place that I was before I ever met her. And it was a huge deal. It was like a Thanos snap, you know, it was a punch in the gut. You know, here we go. Everything's gone. And I remember I was going to drive to, I was going to drive to Gallatin, buy a gun, and then drive somewhere way off to make sure, because my biggest fear of committing suicide was that my family would somehow find me and that they would see me. I didn't want that. You know, my little brother and sister were really young at the time, and I just did not want that. You know, I just, whatever I had to do to keep them from seeing that, or my biggest reason for not committing suicide was the people that I leave behind, you know. And so I was going to drive far enough away that by the time they would ever get there, that they would have my body cleaned up or something, you know. The logic doesn't work out. I know that they still had to identify the body, but at that time, that's what I was trying to do. And I was on my way. I hadn't got to Gallatin yet. And I get a random text from two really good friends. And they were just like, we just want to tell you we loved you. And it was just a random, like, I talked to them later and they were just thinking about me at that time. They knew that I was, you know, going through some stuff. And they just said, we just want to tell you we loved you. And that was enough to snap me back into reality and to just, whoa, what am I doing? What am I about to do right now? You know? And so I turned around and came home. And, it was a ridiculous decision. And there were a lot of pieces that didn't make sense and that I did not find out until about a year and a half, 2 years later. I quit drinking because all that time I was just suppressing it. Don't think about it. Don't deal with it. And I woke up on my buddy's couch one morning, covered in my own vomit. And I had a bruise on my arm that looked like a hand because he had to drag me from his Jeep into the house. And he dragged me by my forearm. And he had to grip it so tight that he put a hand-shaped bruise on my forearm. And I was just, for the first time, I saw myself in the mirror, you know, the proverbial mirror. I'm like, this is ridiculous. Like, this is out of control. And I was like, I got to quit. I knew that that wasn't who I was. And I knew it wasn't who I was supposed to be. And I didn't want to be that, you know. So I just made the decision, I've got to stop. And when I stopped drinking, all of those emotions and all of those, everything that I'd been suppressing, it came back like a tidal wave and just like washed over me. And I was just swept under the current, you know. And so I texted her and I'm like, I was stupid. I was like, I should have been a better husband. I should have, you know, I was so immature. I was just, you know, just pouring my heart out. And I was like, is there any way that, you know, maybe we could maybe have another chance or even just to be friends? You know, I'm so sorry, you know. And I texted her that and sent it and didn't get a response. And I called her dad. I was going to try to talk to him. Maybe I thought maybe she'd change her number. And her dad tells me, he's like, everything that happened is your fault. You did that. And I can't remember his exact words, but it was something along the lines of that, you know, you really hurt her and, you're going to have to live with that. And like, he gets off the phone and I was like, okay. And so I was like, okay, then I guess I'll leave it alone. About a week later, I got a summons to court. Cop knocks on my door. Supposed to appear in Allen County Court that day. And I didn't even, like, when the cop got there, I didn't even have time to make it to the courthouse. He's like, you're going to have to call up there and let them know you're going to be late. And I'm like, are you serious? This is the first time hearing of this? And you're telling me, oh, yeah, you're going to be late too. Like, really? So I called up there and they pushed it back. And so when I get there, she's there, and my former pastor was there, and I go up to the stand, and she's like, she tells the judge that I was abusive in our marriage, and that I had been texting her, and she felt threatened, and she said she was pretty sure that I was driving by her house real slow, which I hadn't been down that road since we were still married. You know, so I don't know where that's coming from. But I know, like, if she was scared, she might have saw a car that looked like mine and stuff. Or I was driving a truck at the time. But it was like, that was the first I'd even had the thought. You know, that was a total shock. That, oh, whoa, I'm in court right now and my ex-wife is accusing me of abuse. And she's saying that I was abusive. And she's saying that she feels threatened by my text. And I told the judge, I was like, I wasn't threatening at all. I was just trying to see if there was another chance. I said, I'll show you the text. Like, you can look at my phone. You know, it wasn't anything threatening at all. And he's like, I believe you. I don't think you meant anything wrong, but she's obviously afraid. So he put a restraining order on me for 3 years. And I had to go to anger management. And like, it was like, just $25 a week, and I had to drive to Bowling Green. And I know it don't sound like much, but driving to Bowling Green once a week and $25 once a week, it sucks. And then I was in class, and, you know, there's all these people that, like, lost it on people at their jobs and beat them with pipe wrenches and stuff. And I'm sitting there, and they're like, what are you in here for? I was like, I didn't do nothing. But my ex-wife is, you know, said she was scared of me in front of a judge. And, like, they're like, oh, yeah, that's what we all say. And I'm like, no, for real. But it was just so, it was such an odd thing. And I didn't really, you know, it's just, it's odd that even at that time, I couldn't see her perspective. I didn't see that at all. And I even wrote, I did a couple of other albums where, you know, wrote songs about the divorce and about, you know, everything that went on, and kind of had a really uppity attitude about it. You know, like, I don't know, like it, I just felt like it was all her, and that I didn't really do, I knew that I was depressed and that I was shitty during that time, but I didn't really feel like I did that much wrong. And this album is really coming back to understanding, oh shit, there's another perspective that, you know, even if I can tell the story and it, you know, wasn't abuse from my perspective, if that scared the shit out of her, you know, if she was truly afraid of me, then that was abuse. She had to live afraid of her husband. I can't imagine. Like, it's so hard to me to think about, even if I didn't mean it that way, her going to sleep beside me and being afraid of me. That's awful. That's awful to think about. It's hard to think about, you know, but that's true.
I think Tyler's point he just made here is very interesting and worth stopping and pausing and reflecting. I didn't respond at the time, but after walking away from the conversation, just thinking how important of a point that was. And basically what I'm hearing Tyler say is something that is important to learn in any relationship, whether it's a romantic relationship, a platonic friendship, or a familial relationship, which... familial is such an interesting word to say. Anyway, it's that of being able to put yourself in the other person's shoes and seeing their perspective, hearing what they're trying to communicate to you, and seeing how you may be being portrayed in their eyes. This particularly stood out to me because it was a hard lesson for me to learn, and something that once I did made me a much better husband, father, friend, or even son. It's one of those things you have to do as you get older. It's something very important in every relationship. It's something important as an individual that we're able to kind of look introspectively at ourselves and how our actions may be affecting others. Seeing how people are reacting to the things that we say or how we're saying them, and possibly realize that maybe what I'm saying is right, but how it's being delivered or being received is all wrong. And it really blurs the lines of communication. And it takes a lot of humility, I know speaking from experience, to be able to step back and recognize, even though you may feel completely right in the moment, that you may be 100% wrong. And so it was very important and awesome. It was very awesome to hear Tyler say how, looking back from his marriage, he can see that his wife was afraid of him. During the time, he knows that he would never hurt her, but the actions that he was doing around the house were portraying something different. So good on you, Tyler, for learning your mistake. And hopefully for the rest of us, we can learn before it gets too late and be able to look ourselves in the mirror and see how our actions are affecting others. Again, this is something I am still learning here at Fade to Gray. So thanks for bearing with me. And let's get back to the show.
What was the aha moment then for you that made you change your perspective, that allowed you to make room for, you know, what she was going through and maybe what her perspective was, and not me versus you? But when did you fade to gray on all that?
I was actually talking to somebody and actually telling the story to him. I was opening up to a girl that I was talking to, and was talking about it, and like in the middle of telling the story, it was like I saw it completely differently. So the change had probably happened in between times that I had thought about it or had told the story. But that particular time, I understood it, and I had told the story or talked about it quite a bit, and was telling it this time, and I was just in tears. I was just, because I saw it, you know, clear. Whoa, you know, that's it. Two different perspectives, you know, that was absolutely abuse from her perspective. And it's just, yeah, it changed me.
Last question about the divorce. Growing up in a Christian background, Christian environment, you know, the support system, like it sounded really one-sided. Like, obviously I'm only hearing one side from you, but as far as your pastor and how we handle that situation, does not sound very pastoral at all. I mean, that's the type of stuff that obviously could send anybody into a deconstruction of faith. When you know, you put a man like that on a pedestal, you're looking at him like, you know, this is like your path to God. You're trusting this man with your marriage and your, you know, everything he has to say. And it just seems like he had zero time for anything that you had to say or listen to your side of the story. And it really sucks that so often churches get involved in people's marriages like that and taking sides.
I want to do my perspective totally, because there's two perspectives of that as well. My perspective is totally, because I was closer to this man than any other pastor I've ever had, and very likely any pastor that I ever will. Because since then, like this whole period was the catalyst of my deconstruction, obviously. But so I've got so many trust issues now. It's so hard for me to actually put that much trust into a pastor again. I mean, we'd eat lunch together all the time. Like he was like a brother to me. Like we were like brothers. Like we were really close. He was my youth pastor before. He was both of our youth pastors. He was my ex-wife's too, and he was actually her youth pastor before he was mine. I visited their church camp, and that's how me and my ex-wife met. So he was close to both of us, but me and him really bonded, and then for that to happen, it was a big deal, totally. But that's my perspective. But honestly, putting myself in his shoes, we were both his youth, you know, we were both... He was close to both of us. And then here is a young girl telling him that her husband was abusive. And he's going to go into father mode. You know, he's going to put himself into, if that was his daughter, what would he do? You know?
Yeah. I don't know. That doesn't make it right. It doesn't make it. It's still like two people and two sides, and for somebody to get that involved in, you know, like you said, he was your father figure too. You know, it wasn't just her father figure. And so, and to be that cold and calloused and, you know, like decisive about it, I mean, it's hard for anybody to go through. I mean, obviously nobody's perfect, and you can't put that much. That's just the problem with putting anybody on a pedestal, because whenever they fail or mess up or do something to hurt somebody else, it's that much more pain involved. But I was more, this question like beyond the man, just the whole like Christianity in general has a stigma on divorce. And so, and with this album that you just released recently and kind of like, you know, maybe an upswing that you're on now, would you look back and you're able to look back and tell these stories, would you say that divorce was the right,
yeah,
the right thing to do?
Yeah, I wouldn't. I've been in the opposite opinion of that. For a long time, I was like, if I had to do over, I would just have just tried harder. I'd have just dug my heels in and stayed. But the situation was what was bad. And like equally, because like with the two different perspectives, what was going on in my head was not what was going on in her. We were on two different separate pages. We would have driven each other further apart. I mean, I think it's inevitable looking back. We would have just pushed each other away. We were so different. And there's the God factor. A lot of people is like, no, but, you know, if, you know, what God puts together, let no man put asunder. And like, you know, if y'all would have just got close to God, then God would have healed your marriage. Maybe, but maybe God didn't put us together. Maybe it was just, you know, us thing, you know. Maybe that's really, and you say what if all day, but I think ultimately we would have just pushed each other further apart. You know, and we're, we haven't talked since all of this, but I'm nearly certain we're even more different now than we were then. You know, I've deconstructed, and I think she's likely constructed more. And so.
All right. Well, we've been talking for about an hour now. You've given me some really, really good stuff. But I want to try to get some kind of pointed questions, just about dating and then about sex, and you kind of like whatever comes to your mind. You don't have to expand too far, but you don't have to like give just like one word, okay, yes or no answers or anything either. So like just kind of, let's see, let's, go with first, dating. You got divorced when you were, if I do my math correctly, 22 years old.
I turned 23. Yeah.
23.
No, it was, we got married in December and I was about to be 20, but I was still 19 when we got married. So I was already 23 when we got divorced.
Right on. And then you are how old now? 28. Okay. So dating apps in 2019 for a 20-something-year-old, what's that like?
I'm sure for some 20-something-year-olds, it works, really does. I'm kind of different. I've kind of recently discovered a lot about myself, and I think I identify as a demisexual. So there's...
I'm naive. So, explain that.
Asexual. It's like a sub thing stemming. It's a stem off of the asexual thing. Asexual is like, you know, they're not necessarily physically aroused often. Like it's very, very uncommon for an asexual to actually be aroused or to actually want sexual activity. Demisexual is odd. It's like half, like that's what demi means, is like half the time sexual. It's a very crude way to explain it, I guess. But for me, it's, I don't fall in love easy at all. And it's like, I realized that I was only falling in love with girls that were my friends already. Like, and I'm like, what is this? And so I would try to date and like nothing. Like I would feel nothing for anybody. Nothing would happen. No sparks, nothing. And it would like, I would recluse at some point very soon after I would start dating somebody, I would recluse. I would shut down and there would be no emotional connection. And I tried to, you know, engage in casual sexual activity and it just wouldn't happen. I even got to the point where I had a girl over and we were super into it. I was into it and we had our clothes off and then all of a sudden gone. I didn't have any.
And this casual dating sexual activity, that was all through the dating apps then at that point, because it was, you were realizing that it wasn't working with your friends, or was that still your friends that you were trying to
have benefits with? So I was always trying to like date and stuff with the dating apps and stuff. But this one in particular, when it had got to the point of almost, normally we had our clothes off, it was somebody that I had been friends with, but wasn't a close friend. It wasn't like that. There was no emotional feelings there. I was questioned, and like, I guess, you know, I got friends that, a couple of friends that are ace, and didn't even know that demisexual was a thing. And then whenever I looked it up, I was like, oh my goodness, like, I relate to that so much. It's like there is no sexual activity possibility unless emotional feelings are there. Like, I'm not even capable of having sex with someone unless I feel really strongly about them emotionally. Because I was like, well, I mean, I was super into it up until a certain point, but there's also, like, I read on there, it's fleeting. Like, you'll be aroused, and then it's all of a sudden gone, because it's just like the realization that you're not emotionally connected to that person. So dating apps for me don't really work, because the casual sex, a lot of people do it for that. That wouldn't work for me. And then also just dating someone that I don't know. I'm a recluse, and then partner that with anxiety that I already have. It's just like, it just never worked. Every single time I would maybe think something was possible, and then it was just gone. I would recluse, like, total shutdown. And the girl that I'm dating now, like, we've been friends for quite a while, so it's working out. But yeah, Tinder's not my cup of tea.
So I heard you mention that you're dating now. So first of all, congratulations. How many serious relationships have you had since your divorce?
This will be number two. Number two. And it's funny, like, it was about 3 years after my divorce, I had a serious relationship. And then it's been 3 years since then, roughly. So that's interesting.
I guess. You're on a 3-year cycle. But like, at least you're getting smarter. For you real, didn't marry, right? The second time around. Right on. So that's cool. Congratulations. That's awesome. It's always exciting, and good luck with that. So how long have you known this girl now, and how did you decide that you were ready or you wanted to enter a relationship?
First time I met her, we were in high school, and I was playing in the worship band, and we played at her church. She was the drummer at her church. And I was checking out the cute drummer girl, you know, like, I was like, wow, she's super cute. Like little Meg White up there, you know, like, I was like, all right, I'm going to talk to her, like, as soon as service is over. And then, like, I'm walking over to talk to her, and she's holding hands with the dude. I'm like, wow, shit, you know. So that was it. And, but, like, her church was in the community I grew up in. So, like, I'd seen her here and there and stuff. But we went to two different schools. She went to a different school. But so we became friends on Facebook a year ago, I guess. And she was dating somebody. And, I'd like her memes and, you know, comment on her stuff and all that stuff. And, we had messaged back and forth a little bit, but I think I was like, you know, you got a boyfriend, so I'm going to kind of like not message you, and I don't know how to word it. It wasn't that awkward, but I was like this.
I think you're pretty.
But I decided to just kind of like back off because she had a boyfriend, and she was dating a guy, and it was about a month or so ago, a month and a half, I guess. She hit me up, and we were talking, and small talk. I was like, so how you been? She's like, just in the single life. And I'm like, oh, really? Okay. You know, green light. And so we were talking, and I eventually asked her out. And it's funny because we went out once, and then we hung out a couple times, and then, like, I reclused. I was like, shit, it's all over again. Here we go. And I had the conversation. I was like, you know, I'm not feeling anything. I think we should just be friends. And it sucked. And I literally felt like, because she had feelings for me really strong, you know. And she told me that. And she said, I had feelings for you when I was dating the other guy. But, you know, I was trying to give him a chance. And So it sucked. I felt like I had killed somebody. Like, that's the amount of guilt and how, like, it just felt so wrong. I even wrote a song about it. Me and Blake Bays have a little rock band called Scott Loves Flowers, by the way. So we got more music coming. But I wrote a song about it called Beautiful Dead. It's really dark. It's a really dark metaphor. But that's the way I felt. I felt like I had murdered somebody because I had just, you know, shut down her love, you know, her feelings, because I just wasn't emotionally capable. And I guess it was a couple of weeks after that, I just was feeling like I needed to give it another chance. And I heard a Copeland song that really, like, made me think twice. It's In Her Arms, You'll Never Starve. I don't know if you've heard that one, but that really, like, whoa. Like, it just kind of put things into perspective. And I hit her up, and we were friends anyway. We were talking anyway. I was like, hey, I think we should give this another chance. And I was completely open ever since then. So it was the right thing to just give it another shot, because, like, got no reservations. Like, we're the same person. We got all so much in common. She's, like, we're, like, the male and female equivalent of each other. So it's pretty interesting. I don't think I've ever had I don't think I've had more in common with anybody I've ever dated. So I know it's early, but yeah.
It sounds exciting. No, it's all very good. So congratulations. That's awesome. Very awesome. How often do you masturbate?
I would say I don't go more than 3 days, probably. I've been, you know, single.
Are you all natural, or porn, or how often do you like a porn when you masturbate, or is it like you like vivid imagination?
I try to stick to stills, honestly. I try not, because, like, you go on, like, Pornhub or something, and it's like, I think Toby's talked about it on the BC podcast, like, it's like this one up thing, like, you end up getting into weirder and weirder shit, you know, and it's like, how did I end up looking at this? And
I want to, like, start a porn website where we just, like, rename all of the videos to something not racist or like, you feel like you're doing something horribly wrong for this stage yeah, scene, you know. Yeah. It's like you're Googling, and then you click on the next video, and now all of a sudden you're like, why am I watching, like, a rape video? like it's not like what's going on here?
Exactly.
So, yeah, I get that.
Like, the percentage of consensual sex on Pornhub is, what, 5% of all the videos or something? It's ridiculous. Yeah. Staged consensual sex.
Well, even the names of it, it's like, it's definitely named for people who have zero, like, self-esteem or zero, yeah, not self-esteem. That's not the right, zero
confidence.
I don't know what the word is. It's like shitty people. It's like, it's definitely, like, worded zero for moral shitty fiber. People. Like, I want to see what this white girl with the black dude looks like. And it's like, there's no longer people. It's just, like, the color and the size of the dude's dick. It's like,
totally.
Anyway, I get that.
Yeah, I try to do steals. But yeah, I mean, I used to have a pretty vivid imagination as a young man, but it just doesn't do the trick anymore. But, you know.
I hear that, man. It was all those movies you went to when you're depressed. describe what an orgasm feels like to you.
A few seconds of natural ecstasy.
Apparently, I have learned from, in fact, I'm just going to say it because he's the editor, from Chris, is, I mean, it can be a lot longer than a few seconds.
Really?
You can prolong that, like,
is he doing
apparently
meth?
Chris,
is it on meth? Because I heard that happens on meth.
I think it's yoga or something. I don't know. It's just that or like tickling the sphincter. I'm
Kegels.
Not sure which one.
He does Kegels all the time.
So, all right. So a few seconds of what bliss, you said?
A few seconds of natural ecstasy.
Natural ecstasy.
Because you can have ecstasy with drugs, but then, or you can orgasm.
I'll take that. We'll take that one. All right. And I guess the last question I'll ask, and you kind of already touched on, but does sex create intimacy for you? Because I know you said you have to have intimacy before sex, but does does sex then create more intimacy, or is it just something nice, but all the other stuff is more important than the sex? Or?
I think it's equally as important, but I think it enhances the intimacy. You can only go so far until sex. Like, sex takes it further. So it's intimacy enhancement, I believe.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Tyler, you're the man. Appreciate you answering the questions. There were some hard questions, and you didn't hold back, and so I appreciate you. So there you have it, guys. Mr. Tyler motherfucking Wicks with his new album, The Bottom.
This series is brought to you by our Patreon members at Fade to Gray. If you're curious about how to be a Patreon member, you can check out our website at fadetograypodcast.com and click on the support link, and it'll bring you to the Patreon page where you can join for as little as $1 a month to be part of a great community that we're building around this podcast. Very proud to be a part of it. Very encouraging each and every day to like just talk with people from around the world about whether it be serious matters or just having fun. Please check us out at patreon.com Fade to Gray Podcast. Tragedy's a tapestry, leaves my insecurity. Sirens serenade me as I fall. Paintings of my memories are all that I am left to be. Candlelight ignites the cannonball. Subsiding disbelief, midnight brings the swelling sea, bodies scattered on the beach breathing. Winds from waters cascading, fan the flame that's flickering, stoke the fire.